This is Hashtag History, episode 89. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And oh my God, 89. That means next week's episode is 90. Can you believe that?
We're 90 years old.
You know what? Actually, I can't believe that. When you put it in those words, it sounds right.
Sounds right. It fits.
It fits. That also means we are almost at the end of yet another season. So we'll be announcing our very special guest for our season 9 finale at the end of this episode. So be sure to stick around for that. Well, with it being episode 89, I thought it was about time I finally covered a topic that I've been dying to cover for such a long time. In fact, when I first learned about this topic, I was so fascinated by it that I actually texted our good friends over at the Herstory on the Rocks podcast, and I begged them to cover a component of this on their show so that I could learn more, and they did. So if you want to learn more, be sure to check out episode 116 of their podcast. I always had the intent to eventually cover this on our podcast as well, but, you know, so much to cover. So little time. Mm-hmm. So episode 90, I'm finally doing it.
Yay. Congratulations.
Thank you. This week, we will be discussing the forced sterilization of thousands of Latinas here in California throughout the 20th century. In 1909, California passed a eugenics law that allowed for the sterilization of people considered to be, quote, unfit or feeble-minded, unquote. Of the 20,000 people forcibly sterilized in California between the years of 1909 and 1979, it was found that Latinas carried a nearly 60% higher risk of forced sterilization than any other racial group. Perhaps one of the most devastating things about this dark chapter in history are the heartbreaking stories of numerous women attempting to get pregnant, not realizing that they had been sterilized. In particular, there was a groundbreaking class action lawsuit in the 1970s that 10 Latina women would bring forward, proving that they had been coerced into signing what many of them did not realize was a sterilization consent form. Due to a language barrier and the fact that some of these women were forced to sign this form while they were literally in labor, many of them did not realize that they had been sterilized until weeks and months later. Some of them didn't realize it until they were attempting to get pregnant again. This episode does have a specific focus on the sterilization of Latina women in California throughout the 20th century, but that isn't to ignore the horrendous stories of Black and Indigenous women, as well as women with disabilities, that were also forcibly sterilized. Additionally, this episode does have a narrow focus on California because, for one, it's our home state, so we love/hate to talk about it.
Yeah.
But two, because California made up 80% of sterilizations throughout the United States during this time period.
Yeah.
80%.
We have a very despicable and embarrassing history of eugenics in our state.
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We do, however, want to acknowledge that harmful eugenics laws were passed throughout the United States and affected tens of thousands of people nationwide, although today's episode is a very focused one.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much to discuss here.
Yeah.
This episode is so horrible. I just want to say that, you know, we cover a lot of dark topics on this podcast, but this one in particular really hit me in the gut, and it actually made me cry a couple times as I researched it.
Rachel.
I mean, it's just so personal.
Yeah.
Can you imagine not being able to have children for something that's completely outside of your control?
Yeah.
I just think that's such a deeply personal thing that is just so heartbreaking. And we never intend to appear as though we are making light of a topic by having a drink in hand while we discuss these important topics. But not gonna lie, it sometimes helps.
Yeah, it does.
It does. This week, though, we don't actually really have a cocktail, but we do have something else to try out. So let's get to that. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption. So this week's quote
cocktail was sponsored by Janae.
Yay!
Who said, quote, "You guys are the best. Maybe you could do a baked goods episode again."
Yay!
And Janae, thank you. We live to serve.
We do. And Janae is such a huge supporter of the podcast. And she really loved when we made cake. We made earthquake cake for the San Francisco earthquake episode.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember her commenting on that. And I think she maybe even remade the cake or tried it out. So I'm actually really excited about the idea of repeating a baked good.
Yeah. So this week, Rachel did me the honor of baking us some Mexican wedding cookies as our baked good, which I believe will pair perfectly with, we did some like spiked eggnog.
Yeah. Think it's perfect.
Yeah. So it's just eggnog with some brandy in it.
Uh-huh. That's perfect.
And nutmeg and cinnamon.
And I think it will pair perfectly because Mexican wedding cookies, it's a very simple batter itself, but you can, I did a traditional recipe, but if you wanted to spike them, the recommendations are to add some kind of coffee liqueur, yeah, like mm-hmm. Kahlua or rum or something like that to them. So I think this simple drink that we put together will pair well with them.
Yeah. So what, just so our listeners know, obviously you can look up recipes online, but like, what are the basic, what's the gist of these cookies?
I'm glad you asked because they have such an interesting history too. So Mexican wedding cookies are very simple batter. It's like flour, sugar, lots of butter.
Yeah.
Almonds, chopped almonds, and vanilla extract. I think that's it. It's a very simple batter, and the batter itself is not particularly sweet, but that's because after you've baked them, you then cover them in
like
powdered sugar, which is very sweet.
Powdered sugar.
Completely coat them.
Yeah.
And then they do have kind of an interesting history. You know, they've been around for centuries, mm-hmm. but because they are such a simple kind of basic traditional cookie, mm-hmm. a lot of cultures have them. So not only are these called Mexican wedding cookies, they've also been called Italian wedding cookies.
Yeah.
They are, you know, there are Russian tea cakes that are very similar to these. And in fact, the kind of interesting history of these is around the 1950s, people noticed that their cookbooks that had formerly said, you know, had recipes that are very similar to this that were Russian tea cakes. In the 1950s, like new editions of these cookbooks were coming out. They had kind of replaced like the Russian tea cakes with Mexican wedding cookies.
Interesting.
Which is interesting because this is all just speculation. This is kind of controversy here. Mm-hmm. None of this is 100% proven to be factual. But in the 1950s, there was like Cold War, anti-Russian sentiment.
Yeah.
So it's thought that perhaps that's why they replaced them. And also in the 1950s, there was kind of this wave of like interest in Tex-Mex and Mexican food. And so perhaps that's why in the 1950s, we started seeing these Russian cookies replaced with Mexican cookies. Interesting, right?
I love that. Thank you for sharing
that. Of course. So before we try them, I have made these before. I've tried them from other people that have made them before too. They are generally like a dry, crumbly cookie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's it.
I mean, like when you say tea cakes, I've never had tea cake.
Uh-huh.
But like, this is what I would picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers with our little cookies.
Cheers. And they're messy.
So buttery though.
It's mostly butter. The mm-hmm. cookie is mostly
so
butter.
Good.
I just spit a bunch of powdered sugar onto my mic.
So good though.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to rate my cookie? My baking?
Oh yeah. Feels wrong, but I mean like 10.
Really? You mean that?
No, I do. I'm not just like fanning your ego here. It's good. It's just like f-ing butter and sugar.
That's all it is. They're very much like butter sugar cookie.
Like, what's not to f-ing like?
I mean, there's nothing not to like. What I love too about these cookies is because the cookie itself, the batter, it's pretty simple. It's not overly sweet. The powdered sugar that you coat it with pairs so well. It pairs so well, but it really does. If the batter was altered sweet too.
I'd try it with the eggnog. So good.
Mm-hmm. I think the best place for us to start is the history of eugenics here in the United States. And again, narrow scope here. We do have on our long list of potential future episode topics, the history of eugenics as a whole. But for today's purposes, we're really focusing on its history here in the States and more specifically in California. The direct definition of eugenics from the Merriam-Webster dictionary is as follows, and I quote, "Stink, stank, stunk." Just kidding. I just wrote that little line is as follows, and I quote, and then I had to. The real definition is, quote, the practice or advocacy of controlled selective breeding of human populations, as by sterilization, to improve the population's genetic composition, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Or, in the words of Francis Galton, a major pioneer of the movement, eugenics is, quote, the study of all agencies under human control which can improve or impair the racial quality of future generations, unquote. Essentially, it is the practice of eradicating, quote unquote, undesirable qualities and traits. Such undesirable qualities include, and please understand, this is not me saying this. This is direct language from early eugenicists. These undesirable traits were things like mental illness, disabilities, tendencies for drug or alcohol abuse, tendencies to be a criminal, even things like poverty.
Mm-hmm.
This may all sound really familiar when we think of Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust, right?
Yeah.
But here's the thing that I know you already know about, because we've talked about this. Many of the eugenics ideas that Nazi Germany got, they got from us here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
More specifically, they got from us here in California.
Yay.
In fact, a leading financier of the eugenics movement here in California sent along details of the program to Dr. Fritz Lenz, a leading Nazi eugenicist, in 1937. When Lenz wrote back, he said, quote, you were so kind to send new information about sterilization particulars in California. These practical experiences are also very valuable for us in Germany.
That actually turns my stomach. I'm sorry.
Yes. I apologize ahead of time, but this episode is very, very disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He closed out this letter by saying, for this, I thank you, unquote. I feel like we've possibly talked about this before, but a couple of the schools and parks near where we live.
Gaty,
exactly. They were originally named after Charles Gaty. Many of them have since been renamed since Gaty, a white supremacist and eugenicist, had also been personally thanked by Nazi Germany for passing along his knowledge in the eugenics field.
I actually did, as a recreation major in college, mm-hmm. we, at Sacramento State, the Arboretum mm-hmm. was once, it used to be named after Gaty,
mm-hmm.
and I did a whole final presentation about that.
Oh,
it was kind of cool.
I didn't know that.
Looking at it, obviously from a recreation point of view, but I went into the history of it and how it used to be named after Gaty. And we also have many roads named after Gaty here.
Yes. Has everything at Sac State been renamed?
Mm-hmm. The Julia okay. Morgan House was once the Gaty House. It okay. was designed by Julia Morgan, who is a famous architect, and it's owned by Sac State now. But okay. it was, I think, once owned by the Gaty family and then like mm-hmm. donated to Sac State. So I think it was named after them as like the Gaty House.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, since then has been renamed after the architect of the house.
But Gaty Road is still Gaty Road,
there
right?
There is one. There's one that was changed from Gaty Road to Riverbend Park.
And that's then right.
There's another one in Rosemont that is still named Gaty Road.
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show how yeah. deeply rooted eugenics is in California history. Sterilization was the common eugenics practice in order to essentially breed out people with less desirable traits. Because we're going to be talking about female sterilization so much, I thought it important to discuss what exactly female sterilization is and how it is performed. If you do get a bit squeamish about these sorts of things, don't worry. I'm not going into any detail. I'm making all of this really quick. But essentially, female sterilization, oftentimes referred to more casually as getting your tubes tied, is the procedure in which you block the fallopian tubes by cutting or sealing them. This procedure is nearly 100% effective at ensuring you will never get pregnant again and is not easily successfully reversible.
That was what I was going to say, is I'm pretty sure it's like not reversible,
correct.
Right?
So, and I'm glad you said that, because I don't want it to say it is 100% impossible to reverse female sterilization, because sure, there are those very, very few and far between cases where they can, or you hear about a woman that, you know, purposefully, intentionally had her tubes tied and then ends up pregnant. But it is incredibly, incredibly rare. The odds of getting pregnant after having your tubes tied is less than 1%.
Wow.
Female sterilization is intended to be permanent, and for the vast majority of people, it cannot be reversed. Like I already shared, 80% of sterilizations as part of the eugenics movement happened here in California.
Ugh. Sorry, I'm just going to keep making like disgust noise.
It's disgusting. While Indiana was the first state to enact sterilization laws, California wasn't far behind it. On April 26th, 1909, California became the third state to institute sterilization laws. The first set of laws allowed for state institutions, so things like prisons and hospitals, to sterilize those who were deemed, again, quote-unquote, unfit or feeble-minded. In hospitals, this oftentimes meant the sterilization of those that were mentally ill. For prisons, this oftentimes meant sex offenders, repeat offenders, and prisoners with life sentences. And for anyone wondering what constitutes as feeble-minded, it can be anything you can possibly imagine. Seriously. This was a catch-all term used by eugenicists to describe anyone that perhaps had abnormal behavior, perhaps a low IQ point. It could extend to someone with mental illness, someone living in poverty, someone with social dependency. It could extend simply to someone who was, quote-unquote, promiscuous.
They would have a field day with people in 2020. I'm pretty sure every single person would.
Yeah.
Qualify as, quote, feeble-minded.
Yes, and we will be covering, you know, a couple of these examples of people that were determined to be feeble-minded. And it's just such outrageous things that in any context, but particularly in today's context,
things we all acknowledge now as part of most people's lives.
Normal.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Like, oh, you're emotional, or mm-hmm. you're depressed, or you're...
Oh, you have emotions?
Yeah.
And you sometimes act upon those? Interesting.
Huh. Weird.
Feeble-minded people were one of the biggest concerns for eugenicists, as they believed that the feeble-minded could be anywhere. Oh, no! They could pass off as quote-unquote normal and then reproduce with another normal person and then create an undesirable bloodline.
Ugh.
I know.
It's so gross.
It's so bad. On June 13th, 1913, the sterilization laws were expanded to include anyone who was, quote, afflicted with hereditary insanity or incurable chronic mania or dementia, unquote. Parental consent was oftentimes sought by the medical providers before performing sterilization on minors, but it wasn't required. And I just want us to repeat parts of that sentence one more time to make sure we picked up on the most important detail. These sterilization procedures were also being conducted on minors.
I just watched a Explained on Netflix. It's a show. You'd actually really like it. It's like a short 30-minute episodes about just random topics. And they
That's
just
cool.
dive into those topics.
Yeah.
And they just did one about teenagers. Mm. And like talking about like why teenagers act kind of irrationally.
Oh, I would
and
love to listen
that.
To that.
Yeah. And it was so interesting, and it just reminded me of that, because this talking about sterilizing teenagers when they're in this part of, they talked about the brain chemicals mm-hmm. and like what's happening with the brain during teenagers' like lives, and it's just so interesting because the reason they act irrationally and stuff is because the one part of their brain that hasn't fully developed mm-hmm. yet is the part that doesn't act rationally.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because you watched that episode and maybe know more about this than I know, but another reason why I've heard, you know, that children and teenagers act the way they act is because, like, the part of your brain that recognizes long-term consequences
yeah.
isn't always there, too. You're thinking so much in the short term.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no looking outside of
yeah.
the moment. I think they said it's the part of your brain that acts rashly is the one part of your brain that hasn't been fully developed yet. It's the one part that hasn't turned to gray matter, as they call it. And so that's why teenagers throughout time have acted crazy, like
including myself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you know, I think about that. I think we've even talked about that on here before, where it's like some things that just felt like life shattering, the end of the world for me when I was 15. When I look back, I'm like, oh my God, that was the silliest, pettiest of problems.
Yeah. Even looking back to like my college years, mm-hmm. I remember thinking there was like a final project in one of my classes that I literally thought it was the end of my world.
Yes.
Life shattering. This is make or break. I'm going to die if I don't get an A on this or something. And now I laugh
yeah.
at it. And that was so real to me in that
Absolutely.
Moment.
Because as an adult, like real world problems, dealing with the health and safety of the people that you love.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really at the end of the day, the scariest, biggest thing in life is everyone you love being healthy and there. Everything else seems so minor.
Anyways, side tangent. Sorry.
No,
teenagers.
Side tangent. That's important. We're talking about
gross.
The sterilization of minors here.
Yeah, that's really gross.
The third and final sterilization law in California was enacted in July of 1917 and yet again created further expansion on the previously instated sterilization laws. These eugenics laws would remain in place until 1979.
To put that into perspective, kids, that was 11 years before I was born.
11 years, right?
Am I doing this right? 79, 89, 90, 12 years.
A decade before we were born, when our parents were in their early 20s.
That's so gross to think about.
I know. One of the largest reasons for why California was so much at the front of this movement and why they made up for more than a third of sterilizations nationwide was due to the time, effort, money, and resources put behind eugenics education here. In 1928, in Pasadena, California, an organization called the Human Betterment Foundation was established. This foundation's sole purpose was to produce scientific data to educate and demonstrate to naysayers the benefits of eugenic sterilization. Propelling this foundation were some of the nation's leading scientists and educators that relayed their pro-eugenics messages to libraries, town halls, even schools. So, as this movement progressed, why were Latinas so disproportionately targeted? Researchers from the University of Illinois and the University of Michigan found that, quote, biases against Mexicans and Mexican Americans were especially prominent. Institutional authorities described Mexicans and their descendants as immigrants of an undesirable type and speculated that they were at a lower racial level than is found among American whites, unquote. Further, Stanford professor and eugenicist Lewis Terman was quoted in 1926 as saying that low intelligence was, quote, very common among Spanish, Indian, and Mexican families of the Southwest. Their dullness seems to be racial, or at least inherent in the family stocks from which they come, unquote.
That's just one of the most, like,
disgusting things.
Disgusting, ill-informed. Yeah. Like, you putting that on an entire group of people, it makes that guy, Lewis Terman, sound f***ing stupid.
Yes.
Ill-informed, naive.
Ill-educated.
Ill-educated.
Uneducated. And spreading harmful, dangerous information.
It's gross.
So I have two forms for us to check out here. These are sterilization forms. And I'm hoping you can identify the justification on these forms that the state used to sterilize these young girls.
So recommendation and approval for vasectomy for the purpose of sterilization. Mm-hmm. And then it has their name, institution, age 15.
15 years old.
Present diagnosis, history of emotional instability.
At 15 years old,
yeah.
She had a history of emotional instability.
I have a history of emotional instability. Feeble-mindedness in any of the various grades is checked.
Mm-hmm.
She has an IQ of 71. Borderline, whatever that means.
Borderline, not intelligent, is what they're saying.
Parents are dead, no legal guardian.
Yeah. And then if you'll check out the other form. So, I mean, their justification on this form is that she is emotional at 15 years old.
Has a semi, like, average, but low average IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another one. This is, again, recommendation and approval for vasectomy for the purpose of sterilization. Age 16.
Mm-hmm.
IQ 69. Catholic again. Number of children, 1.
Yes. That is one thing to note.
Yeah. Education ungraded. Family history. Mother thought to be mentally deficient. Other family history apparently negative or nervous or mental diseases. Clinical history. Mentally deficient Mexican girl.
Mm-hmm.
Sex delinquent. Had 1 illegitimate child. Truant and disciplinary problem. Committed for care and supervision. Present diagnosis, mental deficiency, high moron level IQ of 69.
So yeah, their justification on this form is her IQ level, the fact that she's Mexican, and the fact that she had a child at 16 or younger than 16 years old. One such horrendous story occurred in 1930 here in California, where a 16-year-old Mexican-American girl named Concepcion Ruiz was arrested for running away with her boyfriend. It was considered to be, quote-unquote, subnormal that a young woman would have sexual interest in a boy, enough sexual interest in said boy that she would run away with him.
People were married at that age a century earlier, so...
Yes. Yes, yes.
That argument's stupid.
And also, again, you know, we kind of talked about teenage development and stuff. Consider yourself at 16 years old. Are you interested in someone else?
Yeah.
Yes.
That same exact episode that I just talked to you about talked about how children develop romantic feelings towards each other at the age of 6. Their first inclination of a romantic something is at 6 years old.
Wow. I mean, I'm almost surprised to hear that information, but also I 100% remember having real, true crushes.
Kindergarten.
In early elementary.
Yeah, kindergarten, I had crushes. Yeah, I didn't necessarily act on those. I didn't know what it meant, but
I also remember feeling at 15, 16 years old, like I had very real, true feelings for someone.
Yeah, there's this quote. Oh my God, I wish I might go find it for you at some point, but there's this quote by one of the Green brothers, John Green and... or Hank Green, mm-hmm. I don't remember, but it talks about teenage love at its core is love.
Yes, because it's what you understood to be love at that time.
At that time. It's you're feeling these things at that time. And for anybody to negate or say otherwise is
I completely agree with that. Because when I think back on this time period in my life too, it's like that is what I knew love to be at that time. Yeah. That was my capacity for love at that time. And that capacity was at its full.
It was overloaded.
In fact, it was over. But anyway, between this subnormal sexual interest and the fact that Ruiz was also reported to have a lower than average IQ score, the courts declared her to be mentally deficient. She was sent to the Sonoma State Home for the Feeble-Minded, and here she was sterilized, despite her not giving them consent to do so, and despite the fact that she verbally demanded that they not. At only 16 years old, Ruiz underwent an irreversible surgery that she did not consent to, and that would forcibly change the course of her life. She would be but one of the 5,000 other people sterilized at Sonoma State Home for the Feeble-Minded. Nearly 20% of the sterilizations performed there would be men and women of Mexican descent. We've told you all before, time and time again, that we are a part of a book club.
What? We have? Have we mentioned that?
Yeah, I think at least 500 times.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Something else we mentioned a lot is how as grown adults with full-time jobs, a side podcast gig, and other everyday responsibilities, it can be hard to find the time to read.
Right. So that's why we oftentimes use audiobooks, and Audible is a great resource for that.
Audible is the leading provider in spoken word entertainment and audiobooks. They have titles ranging from news, self-development, business, fiction, and more.
Not only do they have audiobooks, they also have podcasts, wellness guidance programs like guided meditations, and more.
The best thing about Audible is that you can download titles to listen to offline, anytime and anywhere, across all devices without losing your spot.
And Audible has thousands of titles for you to choose from. Maybe pick one of our recent favorites, such as The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires by Grady Hendrix,
Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow.
That was a good one. I love that one. Try out a free 30-day trial now when you use our link at www.audibletrial.com/#history.
That's www.audibletrial.com/#history.
While Mexican-American men were also victims of the California eugenics movement, Mexican-American women were specifically targeted due to the disgusting stereotypes that Latinas are hypersexual, promiscuous, and that they are more fertile than women from other racial backgrounds.
I also want to talk about the fact that women... I know that men were also being mm-hmm. targeted for this, but from what so far, it seems like women were more
yes,
than men.
They were.
And that's gross because A, women's procedures are more intrusive mm-hmm. and not reversible, as you said, which is probably the reason they did it, whereas men's tend to be easily reversible.
In addition to, men can reproduce at greater rates than women can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a point?
No, that was it.
I'm just kidding. Not only was sterilization in Latina women used as a means of stopping the reproduction of low intelligence offspring, but also to stop the rate at which they were being produced. In other words, population control. I also think we need to put into context the anti-immigration and overall anti-Mexican sentiment there was running concurrently to this mass sterilization. As part of the Immigration Act of 1924, the U.S. Border Patrol was formed. Additionally, during the late 1920s, America was in the midst of the Great Depression, with white American men accusing men of Mexican descent of stealing American jobs. In fact, during the time of the Great Depression, upwards of 2 million people of Mexican descent were forcibly removed from the United States, 60% of which were American citizens. Something else that many people don't know is that racial segregation in schools did not exclusively apply to black and white children. In some cases, it also applied to Latino children. There were restaurants and movie theaters and public pools that would not cater to Latino Americans. Keeping all of these things in mind can help us further grasp the context of Latina forced sterilization throughout the 20th century. One of the most devastating things to come out of the forced sterilization of Latinas came in 1978 when 10 women brought a federal class action lawsuit against the Los Angeles County USC Medical Center, Dr. James Quilligan, health directors, and state departments for sterilizing them without their informed consent. This became known as the Madrigal versus Quilligan case. Each of these women have such horrendous and devastating stories, but I want to highlight a few of them. Beginning with Dolores Madrigal, the named plaintiff in this case. She said that while she was in the hospital, in labor with her second child, medical staff approached her multiple times about getting sterilized. She was hesitant, but they assured her it would be better this way. They told her that her husband had already agreed to the procedure after they told him that there was a possibility that she could die if she tried to have another kid. Additionally, they lied and told her the procedure was reversible. Without actually knowing what exactly this form that they kept shoving in her face said, Madrigal signed it. Another one of the plaintiffs, Estela Benavides, had a very similar story. For Rebecca Figueroa and Maria Hurtado, they were under the impression, and might I also add, under the influence of heavy medication, that the forms that were being shoved in their faces were consent forms for the C-section operation that doctors were about to perform. It would be weeks later when they realized they had signed consent to be sterilized. Can you even imagine that? Obviously, you're about to have a C-section performed and you think that this form shoved in your face is consent for that operation.
Yeah, because the people you trust, your doctors, yes, are telling you so.
Yes. Some of the plaintiffs in this case never even signed consent forms. One woman, Georgina Hernandez, distinctly remembered refusing sterilization multiple times while in labor. Despite this, the doctor sterilized her anyway and would later lie and say that she had given consent, but just couldn't remember due to the excessive pain and bleeding that she was experiencing at the time. Another woman, Maria Figueroa, agreed during labor to be sterilized, but only if her baby was a boy. She ended up giving birth to a girl, and the doctor sterilized her anyway. Much like the story of Hernandez, the doctor lied and told her that she had given her consent even when she knew she had not. Some of the women simply gave in after such intense pressure to sign the forms. One particular plaintiff, Jovita Rivera, said that while she was in labor with her second child, she was told by the doctor that, quote, I had too many children, that I was poor and a burden to the government, and I should sign a paper not to have more children, unquote. She was also lied to and told that the procedure could always be reversed, and thus she decided to sign the forms. For other plaintiffs, they were denied pain medication if they did not sign the form. For others, their babies were denied care if they did not sign the form. But for all of these women, the one thing that they all had in common was that not a single one of them wanted to be sterilized. Under the worst possible circumstances, when in extensive labor pain, given false and untruthful information, and for many of these women, there existed a language barrier, informed consent was not possible. In fact, experts have said that when in extreme pain, you cannot give informed consent.
Yeah, that's why they say like torturing people is, mm-hmm, you can't get actual results from it because,
yep,
people would do anything to get out of those situations,
yes,
or make decisions that
aren't sound. Well, and I can imagine in this situation, you're in extensive pain or under heavy medication. And if you are being pressured over and over again to sign a form, perhaps you just do it.
Well, and you're told that it's reversible.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing. That's the one thing that you've continued to say over, mm-hmm, and over again that I'm like, in, sure, that moment, oh, it's reversible? Okay, if I yeah, change my mind, I'll come back and, yep, we'll get it reversed.
Yep. And I think of the one woman that was told that her husband had already agreed to it. And I think,
yeah,
that it too is persuasive and manipulative.
Yeah.
And then for some of these women, they never signed the forms and were essentially gaslit and told, oh yeah, you did. You just don't remember, mm-hmm, it. One of the witnesses for the prosecution in this matter, a handwriting expert, actually compared the signatures of the women on their consent forms to their normal, everyday signatures and found there to be a drastic difference between the two, indicating that the women had been in excruciating pain and or on heavy medication when they had signed the sterilization consent forms. Most devastating to me are the stories from these women who did not realize that they had been sterilized, returning to the doctor several weeks to months later and learning then. I cannot even imagine. I cannot imagine the level of pain and devastation and disappointment to learn that you will never be able to have another baby. That is just so heartbreaking. An anthropologist who testified during the court case actually talked about the emotional, social, mental, and psychological effects that forced sterilization can have on a woman. A major one being that they lose a sense of self and purpose, which can lead to depression, anxiety, strained relationships, and more.
All the things that they're claiming these women are, like,
mm-hmm.
Depression, anxiety.
Yep.
Not of yep. sound mind, or however they phrased it before.
Feeble-minded. Mm-hmm. And one thing that this anthropologist said, too, is, you know, it can lead to strained relationships with their partners and
the children
that they do have.
Oh, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. If you lose a sense of yourself, if you had these goals and these dreams for your life and family, that's why this one is just so personal. It's just like the personal liberty to have children being stripped away from you without your control.
Yeah.
It's just heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Although her testimony would later be dismissed by the judge due to relevance, one witness for the prosecution did state that she had overheard Dr. Quilligan and others at the hospital perpetuating the harmful stereotypes of Latina women being hyper-fertile. She also testified that the LA County Hospital had received a federal grant if they were able to reduce the birth rate of Mexican and Black Americans in Los Angeles. This case was not brought before a jury. Rather, the attorneys on both sides decided they would rather have the judge make the final decision. And you're not going to like the final decision the judge made. Ultimately, Judge Jesse Curtis sided with the hospital, stating that the doctors did not do anything wrong and simply had the patient's best interest in mind when they made the decisions that they did. The judge said it was fully within the rights of a doctor to, quote, improve a perceived overpopulation problem.
No, it's not. That's not. Doctors take a Hippocratic oath,
mm-hmm.
stating, like, it's their one and only cause is to help mm-hmm. help people, right? Mm-hmm. To save people.
Not to do family planning
and birth control.
Yeah.
And
in direct contradiction to the request of the people that they are serving.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this judge decided that this had all simply been a miscommunication. While these women would never receive legal justice, nor would they ever be able to conceive again, there were some legacies that came out of this trial that we can say cheers to, I guess. It was this trial that led to forms and hospitals being translated into multiple languages, as well as a new policy put in place that patients under the age of 21 were given 72 hours before making any decisions about sterilization. It also should be noted that a lot of hospitals now utilize the services of translators too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in 2018, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors issued a formal apology to the women, but nothing more than that.
Thanks.
There's no repairing or rectifying not being able to have children again. In 1979, not long after the Madrigal versus Quilligan case was settled, the practice of forced sterilization throughout the state of California was abolished. By the time it was all over, some 20,000 women had been forcibly sterilized. Despite the practice being abolished, California still saw instances of it in state prisons afterward. Between the years of 2006 and 2010, an audit found that 144 women in state prisons had been illegally sterilized without their consent. It is estimated that there were about 100 other women that were also illegally sterilized while in prison in the late 1990s. In March of 2003, former California Governor Gray Davis made a formal apology for the state's involvement in the eugenics movement. In June of 2021, current California Governor Gavin Newsom approved $7.5 million for reparations for all survivors of forced or involuntary sterilization between the years of 1909 and 1979, as well as survivors of any forced sterilizations performed in prisons after 1979. Another sad ending to an episode, but how do you end something like this?
Yeah, sorry guys.
Bad way to end almost the end of the season. But I just think, you know, we talked about this already, but this one hits me, hits us exceptionally hard just because there is nothing that can ever be done to repair the damage inflicted. It's a tough one, but one that is really important to talk about and to know.
Yeah, and I think that many people don't.
No.
I think people are surprised when they hear about the history of California's mm-hmm. eugenics program, mm-hmm. but also the United States in general. Like,
yeah,
this is all very shocking news.
Yeah, that's what came up in a lot of my research was, you know, people trying to educate others about California's history because they were saying they are oftentimes faced with people that don't believe them, that don't know
yeah.
anything at all about California history when California was a front runner of the eugenics movement.
Yeah. I think that's one of the I would say the negatives of being in such a progressive state is people don't necessarily mm-hmm. believe or understand how we got here and the negative yeah. histories that happened before all of this.
I agree. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
We will share the pictures that we discussed on the episode to our Instagram, and all sources used to put together the episode can be found on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use, share about us with your family and friends, and then give us a rate and review.
And circling back to Instagram, be sure to check us out on there at #history_podcast. You can also find us on TikTok at #history and on Twitter at #history_.
And you can also come check us out on Patreon. If you join us over there for $1 a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. You also get access to some behind the scenes content, weekly hashtag hangout episodes, and we mail you cards and stickers.
And now, to announce our special guest for our season 9 finale next week.
Yay! We are so ecstatic to have Amber Hunt from the Crimes of the Centuries podcast joining us next week.
Amber is an award-winning journalist and part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Cincinnati Inquirer.
She is also the host of the Crimes of the Centuries podcast, which I just saw this morning that Rolling Stone named one of the 10 best crime podcasts of 2021.
Wow. We are so excited to have her on the show and cannot wait to see you all there.
Thank you all so much.
Bye.
Bye.